Paul Taylor found out that there was a vacancy. He sent the air tickets around to the office by taxi, and they wanted me to fly up the next day. Well, I had some matters that had to be cleared up in Perth, and some business to finish, and some people to see before I left for the wilds of the Pilbara. And I had to brush up on my suntan, because there's nothing worse than going to the Pilbara being lily white. And so I think it was a week later that I made my way to the airport at Perth and up to Cape Lambert. And I went on my induction on the first day, and I was supplied with various bits and pieces of equipment. And the next morning, I went and sat outside the main workshop on my toolbox, waiting for someone to come and pick me up to take me down to a particular job. And the manager, Keith Taylor, came out and said to me, "Arthur, where would you like to work?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you tell me where you want to work and I'll make sure you get that job." And I informed him that I wasn't fussed about where I worked. I understood that there was a transfer system on the site, and that I would work wherever I was directed to go on a temporary transfer, but I was connected to the main workshop crew, and that I would work in accordance with the transfer system in the award and the union's policy on the site. He went away, and I worked in a primary crusher area for some time on day work. I then went back to the main workshop at the end of that period, and I worked in that area for a while. I was then transferred to the plant, and I worked in the plant area for a number of years on day work and some small periods on shift for a couple of months at a time.
Was this mostly maintenance work?
It was all maintenance work.
Maintenance and repairs?
All maintenance and repair work.
And is this sort of very similar work, or was it varied work?
The work in the main workshop was varied in terms of it was boiler making work, fabrication work, working off drawings from time to time, welding. But in the plant and in the primary crusher areas, it was very similar work. It was basically maintenance on the run.
Keeping things going.
Keeping things going.
Yeah, I think I forget who it was.
Patch up work.
Said to me, you know, that you were 6 months.
Well, boilermakers work's decidedly different from, for example, fitters or toolmaking, in that in the mining industry, it's basically the repairing of chutes, conveyor systems, rollers. It's fairly simplistic boilermaking work.
Yes.
And it's working, you know, things that are coated with iron ore, dust and water and corroded. It's no good putting a spanner on them. You just got to cut it to destruction and just replace the equipment. And in those terms, it's very simplistic fitting work. Simplistic and crude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do need basic skills, and you do need some understanding of how things work until you get to the areas where you've got to replace pumps or drive pulleys and strip them down or rebuild them or whatever. I mean, that requires a, you know, fairly high degree of expertise.
So the work, I presume, would be comparatively boring, wouldn't it?
Yes, it can become boring.
Well, what, you were living at Wigan, wasn't it?
That's correct.
And where did you live at Wigan? Was it in single men's quarters or a house?
I lived in single men's quarters.
Are they those aluminium transportable things, or have they gone beyond that?
They've gone beyond that. That were the early days. In fact, the single men's quarters at Road River now are of a fairly acceptable standard. And the standard really did increase in the early 80s because there was a housing policy, or a housing committee, and on that housing committee were representatives of the various trade unions along with management, and they determined what was built, how it was built, how many of them were built, and who went into them.
Okay.
And that was decidedly different from any other company in the Pilbara. It was a very progressive attitude, I think, by the company to involve the workers in the accommodation.
Was that their idea or was it the union's?
I think it was born out of necessity, out of all those industrial disputes in the early in the 70s. The unions put it up, and I think the companies were susceptible to it because they saw that it was a way to get the results that the workers desired and also to get the proper accommodation built. I mean, there's no good building accommodation and then having further arguments and disputes over it.
Was there, this was the end of the 80s we're talking about, when did you
I started in 78, maybe.
Yeah, well, was there a labour shortage up here? I mean, was it...
Yes.
So in fact, experience like yours of being hard to get on was not... Well, they just put you on and turn up at the door, or did you still have to go...
Companies employed from Perth, but they did employ locally. And in the 70s and up until the early 80s, as I said, there was a high turnover in the workforce, and companies would be very grateful to get skilled tradespeople. And in fact, any form of labour, whether they were tradesmen or people travelling through, looking itinerant labour, looking for work, anyone, they were very glad to employ people because of that high turnover.
I wonder why they... this, you have to go to Perth to get a job. Was this because head office was there and head office was sort of wanted to
I think that was the primary point, that the hiring should be done through Perth, was maintained by the companies. But also it didn't help matters to have large numbers of people wandering around the mining communities, because after all, there was no accommodation for them. And,
so they weren't encouraging sort of drop-ins and getting them up here on spec and all that sort of
stuff. No, I mean, very disastrous situation for people coming in and out of here on spec, and I mean, it still goes on, and the fact that these people finish up living in the bush or out of back of cars, and I think unions started to say, well, look, don't come here unless you've got a job, because there's nothing else for you to do and there's no way you can earn a living.
People turn up with no money.
And I think that shown a lot of people in the Pilbara that in the 80s, when you do get a lot of people coming from other parts of Australia looking for work, how chronic the employment situation is in the rest of Australia, with large numbers of people coming to these areas.
Yeah. You were in the main workshops, you were Boilermonger. Were you involved in the union? I mean, what was the union? Explain to the organisation of conveners, shop stewards, etc. Conveners is a term I've never heard in the years.
Yeah. The history at Robe River of the unions, for example, the metalworkers' union, is that the rank and file elected shop stewards in their areas. The shop stewards elected a convener. And a convener is a shop steward. He's the head of the... He carries out the decisions of the shop steward, informs the companies, holds the meetings, and convenes meetings of the members in areas or after work, or has the responsibility of the carriage of industrial matters between the membership and the employer. When matters get beyond the simple foreman worker level.
And this, the cliffs and any other place, these conveners were paid by the management?
Yes.
Well, they were doing it in the boss's time.
That's correct.
And is this the same line with the Pilbara?
Yeah. It was to varying degrees. At Roe River, it was in its most advanced form, in that they were full-time conveners, paid completely by the employer, and only at Cape Lambert. At Panawanika, it was slightly different.
Even at Panawanika, was owned by the same company.
Owned by the same company. The convener worked on the tools or at the job, but had a roving commission to go on industrial business when required.
And Tell me, what goes on at Panawanika? That's the mine.
That's correct.
And where are the most of the workforce live? At Panawanika?
Yes.
I see. And was there sort of a when you said, well, things were slightly different at Panawanika to Cape Lambert, was there a transfer between those places? I mean, for instance, we often be told to go down to Cape Lambert and work for a fortnight or sort of thing. Was that
never. Never. There were transfers between the sites on the basis of that if the worker wanted to transfer because of family reasons, maybe his children were growing up and they wanted to go to school, there were not the facilities at Panawanika, then he would put in for a transfer to go to, and if a vacancy came up at Cape Lambert, he could go there. And there were very, very few instances of traffic the other way. However, in recent times, the employer has decided that workers would be transferred on a daily basis or weekly or monthly, or on some occasions he's attempting to do it permanently between Cape Lambert and Panawanika, and on occasion between Panawanika and Cape Lambert.
And Wickham.
Well, Wickham's the community, Wendy, but Cape Lambert is the actual centre of operations. There are jobs for road workers in Wickham, but that's in the providing the town services and stuff.
So Cape Lambert hasn't got housing or anything?
No.
It's Wickham, I see.
Yes.
And is when you say of recent times, you mean since the stroke?
Yes.
And is this being resisted by the unions?
Yes, it is. And the unions are taking action to support workers in the Industrial Commission, and
but in fact, it's with the lack of the penalty clauses, it's a bit hard to, you don't have many sanctions on the employer. You know, they have to do what the court tells them, you don't have the commission tells them.
I think in layman's terms, that's quite correct. I think when you're dealing with a industrial relations system that is primarily built around laymen, and then overimposed upon it is a legal structure aided by an employer who has access to vast resources to appeal and oppose and buttress anything that an Industrial Relations Commission can do. You start to have the sorts of problems that unions are experiencing at the moment.
Yeah. Yes, and it's all made a bit worse, I presume, by the fact that up here you're a fair way removed from the union leaderships. From the union, just physically, and you're a bit on your own.
That's very much the case, yeah. The old story is that I remember the construction workers telling me about the location allowance up here. Perth is the most isolated capital city in the Western world, and Karratha is 1,000 miles past it, and therefore that's a good enough basis to put in for a district allowance and or a location allowance. And that's the problem with unions and its resources. They don't have enough of them, and what they do have are concentrated in the capital cities. I think the unions and to be given some credit in the Karratha area, the state unions and the local people that are here, in terms that they have poured money into a joint union centre, and they've provided a central facility, and I think that's been a very positive step. I think there's a lot more to be done yet in that area, and hopefully the next years we'll see something of that.
Yeah, I wasn't so much thinking of, what I was thinking of was any leadership that's a long way. How far is it to Perth? 1,200 K or something?
Yeah.
Any leadership, that's a long way away may find it hard to understand the pressures and the feeling of the workers. Isolated workers tend to feel the union leadership doesn't know enough, may tend to feel the union leadership doesn't understand their problems.
I think what you say is entirely accurate if you put it in the context of the 70s and the 60s, and perhaps even the early 80s. But I I don't think that comment is accurate anymore to any great extent, because a vast number of union officials that operate in the Pilbara, and certainly the majority of officials that operate from Perth in the Pilbara, at whatever level they operate, have great experience and knowledge of the Pilbara. They've either worked here or have spent a lot of time here. But the problem of distance in terms of leadership still exists, but it's not a question of that they don't know what goes on.
No, it's just that, for instance, in eastern states, having, you know, I understood and thought that the Pilbara strike had been much more of a victory than in fact it was on the ground. I mean, it was a victory in that there is still a union organisation which has not been destroyed, and it might well have been. But when you come close to seeing what's happened to people in Wigan and that sort of thing, you realise that it wasn't by any means a sort of victory. I presume, for instance, that those staff people would have, you know, got their jobs back, and you would have, when you on an appeal to the Industrial Commission, which of course they didn't, and I said they're still getting people. They are. So in fact, it's been a partial victory, hasn't it?
Well, yes, it has been a partial victory, and it depends from what sense you view it. In the overall political sense, I think the unions had a massive victory. In terms of what's happened to our membership and what's happened to the membership of other unions and workers and their families, I think a lot of people have been devastated. And there's no denying that, and the massive loss of jobs and the trauma and the illnesses and that have occurred. I think there's another face to that, that it's right to compare it to. There are still employers in this state and in this area that are far worse than what's occurred in recent times on the road. And they've even got a lesser union organisation in those areas. But Wendy, you're right. It is only and that's not no pun intended. it's only partial. Yes, and I think that the overall political climate in this country, the responsibilities of unions is to try and point out to people what happened at Robe River and the effects of it, and that there are some people in this country that would love to see the whole country, or want to see them go through what workers on the road went through, and I wouldn't wish that on anyone.
Father, I reckon this is doing very well, because what we're laying... playing back. Arthur, you said a minute ago that there were employers around here who were far worse than, or where workers have far worse conditions than what they've got on the Robe now. Tell me about some of those. Speaking of contractors or what?
Contractors and small employers. Some of the employers that employ 20 or 30 people in the more isolated parts of the Pilbara, where they don't receive the attention of union officials and don't have access to shop stewards or an organised structure, and usually only come across those places, Wendy, when someone gets sacked or something disastrous happens, and then you get into it and it's like lifting the lid off a can of worms.
Yeah, the conditions of the major iron companies that you've negotiated over the years haven't sort of come down, led to an improved standard, or have they led to an improved standard in some ways with other employers? Have they must put certain pressures on other employers, don't they?
It's certainly made other employers within the Pilbara lift their game. Now, those same employers in the southwest of the state are probably operate at the standard that applies in the rest of the state, and that is equivalent to the amount of union organisation within the area so on and so forth.
Yeah, in a way. Now, perhaps you could explain to me the subcontracting system. I think they call it pyramid subcontracting or whatever. Is it what they call it? It's sort of where subcontractors.
Yeah.
Explain to me how that works. Does it work for your members? Do you have any members involved with...
We don't have any members directly involved in pyramid subcontracting. It's a method that is somewhat peculiar to those within the building industry or building trades, and it's something that's foreign to the metal trades industry, but from time to time there are unscrupulous employers who try to implement that method. The method simply is that, for example, there's a major job to be performed, say in construction. A major contractor will take out that contract. He will then sublet that contract to another contractor, who will then segment the contract into its various facets and put other contractors onto it, so that between the worker who's receiving wages and the client, if you like, whose job it is, who's going to finish up owning it, there may well be a tiered system, or as it's aptly described, the pyramid system of employers.
Might you get to the very bottom and find the blokes who would normally be on wages are subcontracting themselves? I mean,
In the metal trades industry, it's usually unlikely for that to occur. When it does occur, it's usually in a limited form, and sometimes only on big jobs, such as the Burrup construction. And there are agreements formed between the unions and the major contractor that pyramid subcontracting won't occur. I mean, the other side of that, Wendy, is in the metal trades area. In some instances, it's unavoidable because of some of the specialist nature of the work. But in those instances, they are controlled and they are confined to specific instances of work. In the metal trades industry, it shows itself in the form of what's known as cash in hand, and the unions are opposed to that, and usually when we find it, we can stamp that out by agreement between the employers and the unions, and or the taxation department becomes involved, and the taxation department stamps it out because people aren't paying their tax.
What sort of... What sort of jobs in your trade would be involved? What would the subbies be doing?
Pyramid subcontract.
Yes. What would the blokes on the job actually? What sort of jobs are they doing?
Well, in pyramid subcontracting, as I said earlier, Wendy, is not something that's rife within the metal trade.
No, I see. Be more like carpenters and that sort of thing, putting on roofs and in building trades.
And in civil type areas. Mm. Now, in the metal trades areas where it does go on, as I said before, it might be some work of a specialist nature, where the major contractors, say for example, a major tank builder, would have to, in certain situations, have to have insulation work performed. That insulation work would be performed by a specialist contractor. For example, on the Burrup Peninsula on one job, there are only three contractors anywhere in the world that can perform...
contractor. He's subcontractor, in other words, he's running. Do you get that sort of, you don't in your industry, but on the borough, on the, in the, in the area, that sort of thing must be a problem for certain unions.
I think it can be. It can be, yeah. And as I've said,
yeah.
in the civil type areas, yeah. It can be a major problem,
yeah,
and in some of the building trades areas. Now, the instance that you give about having a strong on-site union organisation and policing contractors. See, after all, major employers, who are fair dinkum, have got a vested interest in making sure that people are members of a union and operate within that structure. Because, as you say, they work safely, they no longer have problems with workers in terms of them working unsafely, in terms of them doing work that they're not supposed to, and they're not equipped and trained to do, and so on and so forth. So whilst the union, if it's got a structure, can impose its view, if you will, major employers, you'll quite often find, will encourage the question of unionism, because it suits their own ends also.
People, there's sort of quite a feeling, I've noticed from speaking to a number of people, both union organisers and just ordinary workers on the job, that some of the major companies, including perhaps Road River mainly, are trying to destroy unionism, to put it to one side and to get rid of union activists, and that they might be wanting or hoping or moving towards going over to major... contracting is a major way of operating.
That seems to be the thrust of what's going on on the robe at the moment. Yes.
Yeah. How could that work in the metal industry? How could you subcontract the jobs that your members do?
Well, once again, it doesn't lead to the issue of pyramid subcontracting. What that employer would do, instead of having the major substantial part of his work being performed by his own permanent workforce, he would bring in a contractor to perform that work. Nevertheless, those contractors have to be paid award wages and conditions. They have to be unionised.
Well, they wouldn't if you didn't have a union.
Well, that's a bit of a conundrum, really.
Yeah, well, I'm talking back as a major, as perhaps a long-term view. There seems to be a very big trend in industry, not only here, to go over to subcontracting, and that is then going to lead to a fragmented workforce, or that can, because such a lot of people come up here to earn a quick buck. And it would seem to me to be an ideal place for, you could actually subcontract your workshops, couldn't you, to another firm, you know, I mean, and or you could subcontract your haul pack part of your industry, and other firms bring in the new equipment and operate it on a contract. I mean,
well, in fact, that happens to a degree anyway, and has always happened. I don't see that of itself as a major burden, if you like, upon the unions or something that's radically new or different. It's something that's always has always occurred. Where it eventually becomes a problem, I think, you know, for the whole country, is that you don't have permanent workforces, you don't have permanent communities, you don't have an established lifestyle, and so on and so forth.
The employer's got no responsibility, for instance, for housing and that sort of thing.
Well, the major employer doesn't, but, I mean, you see the contractors that have operated in the iron ore industry for many, many years do provide housing, do provide... certain set standards and conditions. Those workers that... Those jobs that require a large influx of people are usually, in shutdown-type situations, which has occurred in the past,